תגור אינונה ברשותת אדור קושו ניגין יחדית אינונה ישבית קימן נורפת ביער הרפוצי גרים מקונק נניה Inuim Nayari Mi
Hello and welcome to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, Executive Director of Ocean Research Project, Captain of the ALT, and I'm sitting here in the Arctic. I'm at about 77 and a half north, sitting on a wet beach, actually underneath this little makeshift shelter I just created. We came in, we did our microplastic survey in Baffin Bay in the last episode. I think the general assumption, and now, you know, we've only done, this is only our second year of doing microplastics trawls here in Baffin Bay up off West Greenland. It was quite difficult with all the plankton in the water. I think that I'm coming to a basic conclusion that any location on Earth where you have ice for 6 months or greater, 6 months or more of the year, you're going to have less microplastics. Now, if you think about it, a lot of these microplastics float on the surface. So the ice is going to act as a barrier. So during the months that the ice is present in the Arctic, the microplastics won't be able to obviously get past that barrier. Now during the time of year when it's not frozen, whatever microplastics do make its way up from the Atlantic, they will get trapped in the ice. And when the ice melts in the spring, you know, it tends to get sort of pushed around. So basically, there is this gyre in Baffin Bay, but I don't believe there's a lot of microplastics accumulating in it due to the fact that it's covered with ice a lot of the year, 6 months at least, probably, you know, 7-8 months. And then it basically, the ice moves away out of the gyre, taking whatever microplastics with it. Now, in order to really further this conclusion, I think I'd have to come back here in the winter and take samples of the ice itself and see how much plastics are trapped in that ice. Now, I don't think that's going to happen with my organization. First off, we're a boat-based research organization. And second off, it's about 200 miles from land. This gyre is in the middle of northern Baffin Bay. In order to get out there, it would be an epic expedition. I mean, you'd need dog sleds. I mean, that's sort of the way they travel up here. So you'd need teams of dog sleds. You'd need a whole bunch of food for the dogs and the people. You would traverse 200 miles out in the pack ice, the frozen Baffin Bay. You know, it would be pretty awesome. You know, I think I would love to do it. But it would probably be a very expensive expedition, and like I said, you know, we don't do research via dog sled. We do it via sailboat. So anyways, we will continue to do trawls. You know, this theory could be wrong. I mean, this is, like I said, there's only been a couple of years of research done up here, and we're the only organization that's doing it. Now, I think that it would also be interesting to do trawls south of where the ice is to see if there is more of an accumulation zone south of the barrier, so to speak. And we will continue to do plastics trawls. I do think a lot of the plastic trash that you find in this area is discarded fishing nets and fishing equipment. The fishermen here will throw their fishing nets into the water instead of bringing them back to land. So when their fishing nets get bad and when they need replaced, instead of bringing them back to land, they just throw them overboard. So you can imagine, you know, there's a lot of fishermen here, which means there's a whole lot of nets that just get tossed into the water. They are trying to make a financial sort of motivation at giving the fishermen money to bring their nets back to shore, you know, paying them a small amount of money to bring their nets back so they don't dump them in the water. I heard last year that they were trying to make this happen. I don't believe it's happened yet. But anyway, so that's sort of where we are with the last project. Also, I need to make a couple of corrections. One, I thought there was strong currents pushing me all around Baffin Bay. I was really confused when I was doing my last radio show. You know, why is this current pushing me so hard? And I was kind of afraid that maybe it was my hydraulic steering was failing or, you know, God knows what, because it just was very strange. But it seemed like it was starting to sort of act more normal. Well, right after I recorded the show, I went inside and it was my watch and I took over and I noticed I was turning the wheel hard over and I was going in a straight line. I thought, this is really weird. You know, maybe there's something caught on the rudder or something. I don't know. So I took a GoPro and I put it in a waterproof case and I attached it to a boat hook and I stopped the boat and lowered the GoPro underwater and brought it back up and looked at the footage. And I didn't see anything hanging off the rudder or anything like that. Everything under the boat. And this is a good way to get a view of the bottom of your boat. Oftentimes, especially out in the open ocean or in the Arctic where it's cold, you're not going to be able to jump overboard and take a look. And if you feel like there might be an issue down below, a GoPro in a waterproof case attached to a boat hook will give you eyeballs underwater to view the bottom of your boat. So I didn't see anything. And then I had Dana, the mate, the third mate, I had him throw the wheel over hard one way, throw it over hard the other way. And I was, again, with the GoPro in the water, we were sort of watching the motion of the rudder go back and forth. And it did look like it wasn't quite doing its job. So eventually, I go over and I look at the rudder post, and the quadrant was slipping. So it wasn't that there was currents pushing the boat around, these strong currents, which would have been strange, as I was saying, because we're out in the middle of Baffin Bay. Normally, currents like that only exist near shore. It was actually, the quadrant wasn't gripping the rudder shaft. It was slipping. And so that was actually quite a relief, because that's a pretty easy fix. And, you know, 20 minutes later, we had it fixed, and it's been fine ever since. And also, I talked a bit about Predict Wind and their offshore app. I should say that it's not an app, actually. It's a program that you download on a computer. So the offshore program is not an app. But anyways, we ducked in here to try to get away from a gale. The last gale that I talked about ended up being sort of much ado about nothing. Weather forecasting up this far north, you know, we're at 77 and a half. It's very difficult. There's no observation stations, so it's very difficult to get a good forecast. You know, everybody does their best, and everybody sort of struggles with this. It's not that one forecast is bad or another forecast is bad. It's just really hard. It's really hard to get a good forecast in, you know, in populated places in the United States or in Europe, let alone way up here. So anyways, it ended up fizzling out, and really, there wasn't really nothing. But then another gale did come. So we tucked into this fjord, and I don't even know what the name of this fjord is. It's a fjord between Konak and the town north of Konak, which is Sjoerpeluk. Sjoerpeluk is the furthest north indigenous population on the planet. And it's only about 10 miles north of here. It would take longer than that to get there by boat because you got to go out of the fjord, you got to go north, you got to go back in another fjord. Probably take a half a day to get there. But, I mean, as far as, you know, as the crow flies, it's only about, I don't know, like 10 miles, maybe 15. It's not terribly far. Now, maybe it's further than that, but whatever. It's not that far away. I wanted to do this radio show, and everybody is sleeping on the boat, and so I threw the dinghy in the water, and I rowed over to land, and we saw this sort of small, dilapidated shack that the Inuit use for hunting in the wintertime. I can't imagine it's used much in the summer, but there's also a few sleds sort of strewn about. You know, they're sort of like camps they use in the wintertime. So I got to the beach, and I got over here, and it started raining, and I raced, you know, after about walking a couple hundred yards, and so, all right, I'm gonna try to make it to that shack, and, you know, I'll do my radio show in that dilapidated hunter shack. So it starts raining harder and harder, and I didn't bring my foul weather gear, so I'm like, you know, sort of kicking myself in the butt for not bringing my fowlies, and I'm starting to get soaked, and you can imagine the rain is like freezing rain. only a couple of degrees above freezing, and I'm just wearing a fleece jacket. And so I start hightailing it, start jogging, and this, things are, distances are a bit deceptive, and this thing ended up being further away than I thought it was, and I don't know, maybe a mile or so, but it's a really rocky path, it's these boulders are anything from the size of an American football to a soccer ball, basketball, and they're all loose. So you step on one and they start rolling around under your feet. It's a really good way to sprain an ankle. So I'm trying to jog across these rocks, and I start seeing the top of this shack, and I'm like, oh man, all right, I'm so close now, and I'm starting to really get soaked. My pants are sweating, my face is dripping, my hair is soaking wet. And just as I'm almost there, about 100 feet from this shack is a river. And this river was only a little stream when we first came in here, but during this gale, which has been going on for about 36 hours, it rained a lot, and this little creek had swelled to a river about 20 feet wide, and it was, maybe 3 feet deep. And I went about a half mile up the riverbed, really difficult terrain, and in the pouring rain, trying to find a way across this river so I could get into this shack and I could get some protection and do my radio show. And I just couldn't find anywhere. And I started throwing rocks in the river, maybe thinking I could build a dam, which was a pointless endeavor, because you throw a big rock in the river and the river just sucks the rock right down the river. It's, it's flowing pretty good. This is water coming down from a mountain. So anyways, I get back to the bottom and I realize I'm never going to make it. I'm not going to make it the last 100 feet. So I turn around and I start walking back down the beach. And I found some tarp and some sticks. And so I made a little shelter, which I'm currently sitting under, with this old busted raggedy tarp and a couple of sticks holding it up. And I'm sitting on this wet board. And it's tiny little shelter. I mean, it's, if I sit up straight, my head hits the top of it, and my back is actually one of the support beams keeping it up right now. It's kind of funny, really. I'm sitting in the Arctic under a tarp right now. I imagine a lot of other people that are on boat radio have little studios set up with nice microphones, and they can check their decibel levels. And here I am sitting under a tarp, soaking wet. But whatever. It's absolutely beautiful here. I mean, looking out, my boat is on anchor just in front of a shoal. It shoals up real quick. I got in as close to the beach as I could so I could get protection from the winds. The wind has mostly died at this point, which again is a bit strange because it was forecasted to blow all day today about 35 knots, but it seems to have fizzled out quite a bit. Now it's just raining and blowing maybe 10-15 knots. Out in the distance, I can see maybe 30 or so giant icebergs. They're just scattered all about. And the sun, when I started talking about 13 minutes ago, there was a rainbow. Now, the sun had come out for a moment, and there was a rainbow. Literally, I could see the rainbow went from one side of the fjord to the other side of the fjord, just over my boat that's on anchor. Again, I came to land because my crew is sleeping. Everybody is sleeping on my boat, so I didn't want to disturb anybody, and I wanted to get off the boat. You get tired of being hemmed up on a boat all the time when we're doing this research. We don't get to land very often because we didn't come here to hang out on land. This isn't a sightseeing tour. This is a research expedition, and we got a job to do. But yeah, it is beautiful here, and I am soaking wet. And it's pretty normal to find, it's normal enough to find some discarded tarps and trash and things of this nature on these little beaches. The Kanak, the Inuit that live in this region, they're sort of a different, I don't know if you'd call it a different tribe, that might be a bit of a too extreme of a way of saying it, but the language that they speak up here, this is the far northern Greenland, 77 and a half north, the language they speak here, as they claim, the people in southern Greenland or in central Greenland, like the people in the capital, Nuuk, wouldn't be able to understand them. So they speak a different dialect of Greenlandic, and they're definitely more of the hunter sort of Inuit culture. This is about as traditional as you're going to find for Inuit people in Greenland are going to be in this region. And they still do a lot of hunting, and they hunt polar bear, they hunt narwhal. When we were getting some fuel a few days ago, this guy came up and said, "Oh, I like your dinghy. I got this foldy dinghy." And he said, "That'd be good for hunting narwhal." And he said, "Look, we just got one." Well, okay, I'll go check that out, I guess. And so we walked down the beach a couple hundred yards, and in this sort of fiberglass 20-foot boat, this rickety boat with this little outboard on the back, he reaches down and pulls out, a narwhal head, by the tusk. Narwhals are the thing that unicorns, the sort of idea of unicorns came from it. Narwhals have this big spiral sort of tusk that comes out of their head. Technically, it's actually a tooth. It's a giant tooth. I don't know what they use it for. They don't use it for, like, hunting or anything like that. I don't know, maybe it's for, like, getting a mate or something along these lines. But anyways, most people think of narwhals as these like mythical creatures, and very few people would go and shoot a narwhal, but these guys shot one right in the face and it cut its head off. But they eat all the meat, they use it. They're hunters. They'll shoot a polar bear, they'll shoot a narwhal, and they'll eat it. But they're very much of that sort of, well, they're as traditional as you're going to get. So anyways, got to cut to a commercial break, and I'll be right back in a moment.
Hi, I'm Sarah O'Kelly, founder of Skipper's Review. I started Skipper's Review because I wanted somewhere online for my local boating community to make connections and recommendations. So now it's up and running. I've been getting out of the office to enjoy the Florida sunshine and to meet some of my members. Each week, you can hear me swapping salty tales with sailors, surfers, swimmers, divers, boat owners, and builders, anyone with a story to tell about their life and their relationship with the sea. So join me, Sarah O'Kelly, with Skipper's Review on Boat Radio.
Hi, I'm Dave Dempsey from Marine Intelligence. If you're the owner or captain of a superyacht, then you know how expensive internet can be. And yes, it's a ripoff. We've made it our mission to revolutionize the world of marine communications. We will find you the best price for your internet by comparing all major vendors. And we do that for free. That's right, no charge to the boat. It's a free service. We get you the best price for your yacht, whether it's just one boat or a fleet of boats. And all the savings will be passed on to you. We can save you over $1,000 per meg. So stop doing what you're doing and visit marineintelligence.net now, before you forget.
Hello, I'm Captain Bob May from Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show, and you're listening to Boat Radio.
Hello, and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, sitting under a raggedy tarp on a sandy, rocky beach in northern Greenland at about 77 and a half north. Soaking wet and freezing cold, but it's all another day in the life, I guess. Trying to keep this microphone dry. So we came up, the reason that we're up here in the sort of Connaught region, in this far northern region of Greenland, is we're doing a survey for NASA's Ocean Melting Greenland program. This is a program, a NASA program, based out of their Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is located in California. They are mapping out Greenland in a sort of unprecedented level. Most of Greenland is uncharted. For instance, this fjord that we're sitting in on anchor right now, there are no depth soundings for this fjord anywhere. It's about a 15-mile long fjord that's maybe, 7-8 miles wide at the mouth. I mean, it's not a small body of water. And there is not a single sounding. It's one of the interesting things, and one of the things I do like about sailing in Greenland is that it is uncharted. So you have to use sort of a combination of observations and sailor intuition and sort of work your way in and out of anchorages. There are rocks hiding everywhere. There are shoals. There is, of course, ice everywhere. You don't know what's in front of you. And so it's really interesting. You've got to be, of course, a lot more cautious. You get so used to having charts. You know, if you want to sail somewhere, you look at the chart and you say, okay, there's a rock over here and, you know, there's a sandbar over there, and so we're going to go in the middle. And now they have these chart overlay on the chart plotters. You know, you can buy the chips. Some chart plotters come with the chips already downloaded. And, I mean, that makes things really simple. You see where the boat is on the chart plotter. You see all the soundings. It really makes simple work of navigating. So here you don't have any of that. You just, it's really old school. I mean, this is about as close to old school exploration as you're going to find. I mean, you're sailing in uncharted waters. You're doing research in places where nobody has ever done research before. But anyways, back to NASA. So ocean melting Greenland, the general idea is that there is a warmer, saltier water column that's deep in the water, maybe 200 to 300 meters down. And it's coming up from the Atlantic and it's eating glaciers from underneath. And this speeds up the flow of the glacier. And as I, you know, explained in a different show, a glacier is a giant frozen river. It sort of moves from the Greenland ice cap down to the fjords, sort of like taffy. It's like a giant piece of taffy, sort of slowly working its way down. And of course, it's a very powerful force, so it grinds its way into the mountains. All these fjords and these valleys were all created by glaciers. I'm actually sitting at the mouth of an old dead glacier. There used to be a glacier right here, right where I am right now. This glacier has receded, and it has left this sort of rocky beach where it used to be. And this is also a really good place to drop an anchor. Anytime you see a receded glacier, you know that there's going to be a decent amount of gravel and sand in the water near the base of it. The problem in Greenland, or one of the problems when it comes to trying to drop an anchor somewhere, is that it's sort of, these glaciers are sort of like someone has come along with a giant ice cream scoop and just scooped out this fjord. So the walls of the fjord underwater are often go straight down. It's sort of like a swimming pool. So imagine your sailboat is like a little plastic toy boat that a child would play with in the bathtub, all right? Take that little toy boat and put it in a swimming pool. All right, now that's you. Where are you going to drop an anchor? Most places, it's way too deep. And as a swimming pool does, it gets deep very, very quickly. You know, you got sheer walls, sheer cliffs going straight down. The only place in that swimming pool that you could possibly drop an anchor is going to be on the top step. But it's uncharted. You have no idea where that top step is. So sometimes finding a place to anchor can take several hours. You keep sort of working your way towards land, nosing up towards the shore, and it's still 300 feet deep, 200 feet deep, 100 feet deep, until you're, you know, like one boat length from land, and finally it gets like 50 feet deep. But at that point, you're way too close to the beach. And this isn't a normal beach. You know, this is a rocky cliff or whatever. And you're way too close to drop an anchor. But you also have to be careful because, you know, you might, you don't want to just like work your way down the shoreline a boat length or two off, because there could be a big giant rock hiding just below the surface. So you sort of back off and you go back out into deeper water, then you sort of punch your bow towards land and slowly motor like you're going to ram the shoreline. And, you know, if it gets shallow, you drop an anchor, and if it doesn't, then you sort of back off and you keep doing this over and over again, sort of jabbing your boat towards land, pulling back, finding another spot, going towards land, pulling back. And it could take a long time before you do find a place. So you look for various geographic anomalies. one thing is good is a location that looks like there's been a rock slide, you know, like an old sort of river valley or glacial valley, a ravine, I should say. It's not really a valley, a ravine that's cut into the rocks where there's a lot of large boulders. This is an area where there's been a lot of rock slide activity. And the idea is that, well, maybe if there's enough rock slides that it might have sort of built up underwater that you can basically go and drop your anchor on. And over time, these rocks do get, you know, some dirt and gravel on them. They get sort of sooted up. But anyways, it's difficult to find places to drop an anchor, and that's why we're here. We dropped an anchor here purposely because we knew there would be shallower water because this is sort of the site of a receded glacier. So I do digress. Back to NASA. These NASA scientists believe this warmer, saltier water column is coming up, eating the glaciers. So it's our job to find this warmer, saltier water column and to map the seafloor. The reason that we're mapping the seafloor is not so you can make charts. You know, the Danish Hydrographic Office may take some of this information and help populate charts with it. They may not. I mean, it's really up to them. They can if they want. But we're not here for that purpose. NASA scientists will use the underwater imagery that we produce to find deeper channels in the water where this warmer, saltier water column might be hiding. And as a rule of thumb, if you go up to a glacier face, and if this glacier face, you know, we're talking 200 to 300 meters deep to find this water, so I don't know, at least 600 feet deep, 700 feet deep. So if you go up to a glacier face and it's only 300 feet deep or 200 feet deep across the entire face, then it's too shallow for this water column to get to the glacier. So you know, okay, well, it's that glacier is not being eaten by this water column. But if you go up to a larger glacier or a glacier that's deeper and it's 1,000 feet deep leading up to that glacier face, then there's a chance that that warmer water column might be there. And so one thing you do is map out the region, and if it remains deep all the way from the deep water trough, which is offshore, you know, several thousand feet deep, if there is another sort of trough coming in all the way from there to the glacier face, then hiding in that will be this warmer water column. So one way to know that the water's there is we drop a probe. It's called a CTD. It's conductivity, temperature, and depth. These probes are used for a variety of different purposes, but we're using it for showing, you know, as you drop this probe down, we drop it down 3,000 feet if necessary. We drop it however deep the water is. As this probe passes through this water column, it will register the rise of temperature and the rise of salinity. So then you pull it back on board. That's an ordeal within itself. I mean, you can imagine trying to lower a probe 3,000 feet off the back of your boat, you know, 1,000 meters down off the back of your sailboat. We use a waterman's pot puller to get it back up. I bought it on the eastern shore of the Chesapeake Bay. It's what watermen use to bring crab pots up from the bottom. And we use it to bring our probe back up. It does make a big difference. Without it, it would be a total nightmare trying to do this research. And of course, you know, every sailboat should have a pot puller bolted to the back of their boat. You know, it's quite yachty. It's sitting right next to our 55-gallon drum that used to be a drum of oil that we use to store wood in. We have a wood-burning stove on our boat. Every boat should have a wood-burning stove. It's, you know, nice ambiance to... I love burning wood. You know, you can have a diesel stove like a reflex heater, but it's just so nice to burn wood. So we're mapping out this area. We've already actually mapped out a section of it, about 380 miles of it. This area, nobody had mapped out yet. Last year, we did like a preliminary survey of this area, sort of zigzagging through it a bit. So we did do some last year, but we mapped it out in detail this year. That part is already done. We have another roughly 900 miles of seafloor we have to map. We've done about 20 CTD casts at this point. We have to do 90 CTD casts total. One CTD cast, one time lowering this probe, can take an hour. So you can imagine 90 of them. That's 90 hours worth of raising and lowering this probe that we have to do. And you have to stop the boat every single time. You can only do this, lowering this probe, in absolute minimal conditions. Because if the wind is blowing 15 knots or so, oh, my legs are falling asleep. I have to stand up. Oh, no, I'm standing in the rain. If the wind is blowing 15 knots or so, it'll push the boat around on the surface. And so it's hard to lower this thing if the boat is being pushed, because that creates scope. And it's really hard to determine how far are you lowering this probe, because there is no, like, feedback from the probe in real time. You just drop the thing, and you have a lot of marks on the line. We mark the line out every 25 feet, so you count it as it goes down. And what you don't want to do is you don't want to bounce this probe off a rock, because this is like a $7,000 probe, and we don't want to destroy a $7,000 probe. So you got to be real careful not to lower it too far, because you can damage the probe. But if you're getting blown around on the surface, creating scope, then you really don't know exactly how far you have to drop it to get it down to the depth you want to get it down to. So yeah, it's difficult research, and mapping the seafloor is basically the same. I'm going to get back into my shelter here. I don't really feel like standing in the rain and the wind, but I was losing circulation of my feet. Anyways, when mapping the seafloor, it isn't as much about the wind pushing the boat around as it is the wave action. You know, you're trying to accurately map the seafloor, and if you're getting knocked around by 3-foot swells, your data isn't going to be very good. So you really need to have 15 knots or less of wind to do this seafloor mapping and to find this warmer, saltier water column to lower this probe. It's not something you're going to do under sail. Most research is not something you're going to do under sail. You sail to get to the research locations, but once you're there, you use your motor to do the research, and then you sail back to wherever, you know, the next location. For us, we have multiple research projects, so we have to sail to multiple locations, and then eventually we got to sail all the way back to the United States later on in the expedition. But yeah, so we mapped out this area, and you know, we can't, obviously, in a gale, we're not going to be able to operate. It makes it hard. The area we mapped out is relatively easy compared to what we have left to do. We have to still map out Englefield Fjord, which is a massive fjord. It's about 100 miles long. It's, I don't know, can be 30 miles wide, maybe. Yeah, maybe 20 miles wide. Wide enough. And it's got a lot of high-rate, large glaciers, and it's very deep. So this is going to be a place where this warmer, saltier water column more than likely is eating the glaciers from underneath. And so there's massive icebergs. All these big icebergs I'm seeing out here, and they're big, big bergs, you know, the size of office buildings, hundreds of feet tall, probably 700-800 feet deep. These are all coming from Englefield. And I'm north of Englefield. I'm the fjord just north of that one, hiding from this gale that's mostly passed at this point. But there is a huge amount of ice. So we'll be trying to draw these survey lines, and there's ice everywhere. And it only gets worse the further in you get. So I don't even know how we're going to do it. It's going to be... And then, you know, there's all sorts of heavy weather up here. It's not like the weather is nice when you're this far north. You know, we're like 800 miles from the North Pole. Weather deteriorates up here quickly. The weather forecasts are hard to get. And so this is a really, really ambitious project we're doing for NASA. And, you know, NASA scientists, they expect good data. You know, there's really no excuses. You got to come up here and you got to perform. And you got to perform at a professional level. So anyways, we got to cut to commercial break. I got to get the blood back in my feet. I'll be back.
Earliest prehistory reveals mankind's innate connection to the sea. From boats of woven reed in Egypt, to Homer's black ships of the Trojan War, down to the naval battles of Greece, Rome, and every civilization since. I'm Brandon Huebner, and I'll present the history, archaeology, and literature that connect us with our past on the sea. All that on the Maritime History Program. Join me as we voyage down through the ages and witness the development of sailing, trade, and much more. the Maritime History Program with me, Brandon Huebner, every Wednesday here on Boat Radio.
This is Edward Smith from OPA Racing.
This is Ken Little, president of Glock Performance Boat Challenge.
Hi, this is Frank Pillsbury with Marine Max and the DFW International Boat Show in Dallas, Texas.
We explore all kinds of boating topics on Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show. Hi, I'm Captain Bob May. We get underway, making way, Saturday evenings here on Boat Radio.
This is Heather Lohe, director of membership for Boat US. Thanks for listening to Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show.
I'm Michael John, and each month on Boat Radio, I'll be looking at life on London's magnificent River Thames, from the dredgers emptying their cargoes of sand and gravel, to the mudlarks combing the shore for lost treasures. I'll be meeting the people, visiting the places, and boarding the ships that work this mighty, muddy artery. So join me, Michael John, for Tales of the Thames on Boat Radio.
Hello and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, Executive Director of Ocean Research Project. Ocean Research Project is science, education, and exploration. I am currently soaking wet, sitting near a beach. You might be able to hear the beach in the background. And I'm sitting under this little, it's like this raggedy tarp I found laying on the ground. There's some random pieces of wood strewn about. This is sort of a Inuit campground. I assume they use in the winter time. I seriously doubt they use it in the summer months. It is beautiful. The rainbow has come back really, really strong. And again, it sort of looks like a rainbow goes from one side of the fjord to the other. And I now see a second rainbow forming behind the first rainbow. And there is something really interesting about seeing a rainbow and then a whole bunch of icebergs underneath the rainbow. But you get a lot of that in the Arctic. You get rainbows and you get fog bows. A fog bow is, I don't know if that's a real term or a term I just made up right now, but a fog bow is basically a rainbow in the fog. So yeah, it's an absolutely gorgeous place. Anyways, I'm sitting here cold and wet, but I wanted to get off the ship. I tried to do this radio show yesterday, but the wind was just howling, and people were being loud. You know, it's not that big of a boat. It is a 42-foot boat, but it's sort of hard to get away from people, and I don't really want people banging and clanging around in my, you know, in the background during my radio show. So I yesterday it was actually a fiasco. We have this folding dinghy. It's always an issue with dinghies on sailboats. What are you going to do? How are you going to have your dinghy? Where are you going to put your dinghy? You only have so many options. One option is to take the dinghy, if you have a hard dinghy, take it and flip it upside down and stick it on your cabin top. And that works for some people under some circumstances. The problem is that I have a pilot house, and if I were to stick a dinghy on my cabin top, on my coach roof, whatever you want to call it, it would impede my vision. I wouldn't be able to see over the thing, and you know that would kind of be pointless, especially when you got icebergs all over the place of all different shapes and sizes in your way. If you had this dinghy you couldn't see around, it'd be pointless. The other option, and it's sort of a popular option, is to have davits, to keep the dinghy off the back of your boat on davits. I personally don't like dinghies hanging off the back of my boat on davits. My boat does have davits. It came with davits. I use my davits. I connected them with some boards and pipes, and I use it for my wind vane. So I also use them as a crane arm for pulling up the CTD probe. This keeps the probe, a good 4 feet or so, 3-4 feet off the back of my boat. And so when you lower this probe and raise this probe, which is a $7,000 probe, you don't run the risk of it banging off your transom. In my case, off the steel transom, which you can imagine would be a bad thing. The reason I don't like davits on a boat, they're okay for some circumstances. And, you know, they do work really well on catamarans, or at least maybe better on catamarans. But out in the ocean, if you get yourself into some serious weather, not just do you have this thing that's bouncing around off the back of your boat, but you could get a big wave crash right in that dinghy. And now you got a dinghy that is full of water that's now several hundred, you know, 100 pounds, 200 pounds, 300 pounds, depends on the size of the dinghy. But you now have this thing on the back of your boat full of water that's bouncing around. Granted, dinghies do have drains on them, but if you're in bad enough weather, you could also get a big enough wave crash that could just rip the dinghy right off the back of your boat. So I don't think it's a very good option. What I do is I try to stow the dinghy. So that means you got a couple options there. You either get a folding dinghy, which is what I did when I sailed from Annapolis to Europe, Africa, the Caribbean, and back single-handed. I had a roll-up Avon dinghy. I think it was like a Avon Red Crest. It was an absolute joke of a dinghy. It was a dinghy that it didn't have a wooden transom on the back. It was basically like inflatable all the way around. You know, the back part of the dinghy was also like an inflatable tube. You know, I didn't have to worry about anybody stealing it. I mean, I guess that's one benefit of having such a piece of junk dinghy. And of course, I didn't have an outboard. I just rode everywhere. I rode that dinghy so much in Europe and in Africa that I ended up whittling down a pair of oars and I broke them in half. I whittled them in the oar locks because I just rode it everywhere. And, you know, I had to get a new pair of oars, of course, and I started whittling those oars down. So by the time I got to the Caribbean, I had to get another pair of oars. And they weren't metal oar locks. They were, anybody who's familiar with this Avon Red Crest, this junky dinghy. I got the dinghy for $150. They're like rubber oar locks that are like built into the dinghy itself. So it's not like I was whittling it down on metal. I was using rubber. You'd think that would have been a little more forgiving. But, you know, it was just a lot of rowing. Yeah, the dinghy sucked. It rowed like crap. And it was a bit of a joke. But the beauty was, like I said, nobody's going to steal it. And more importantly, or most importantly, is that I could roll that dinghy up and I could stow it in the cockpit locker really easily. So I could get the dinghy completely away, out of sight, out of mind, stowed away. And that, you know, for me, having a boat that is prepared for the ocean, prepared for gales, prepared for all the things the ocean is going to throw your way, is a much higher priority than having a nice dinghy with a fiberglass bottom that you strap down to the front of your boat. Now, that was a 32-foot boat. That was a Pearson 323 that I used on that trip. I lived on that Pearson 323 for about 6 years. I had the boat for about, I think, 7-8 years total. A nice boat. You can get, you know, Pearsons are sort of like Chevrolets. You can get one for a pretty cheap price, but they might be even more dependable than a Chevrolet. They're really good boats, all things considered. You really can't go wrong. If you don't got a lot of money, you can't go wrong buying a Pearson. And you can sail one across the ocean if you want. I did. You know, I sailed one across the ocean twice. So they will do the job if you want them to. Although they are designed as coastal cruisers. So anyways, you can do a folding dinghy, and my boat doesn't have any outside storage because I don't have a cockpit. I have no outside steering on this boat. I have a pilot house. The steering is done inside the pilot house. There is no storage anywhere outside. So my option, I got one of these folding boats, and you know, a folding boat is a interesting combination of incredibly flimsy and incredibly stable. So I literally can stand in this thing and jump up and down. I have no concerns about it flipping. And this is one of the problems with a hard dinghy, is some hard dinghies are incredibly unstable. And I have seen more than one person, including myself, flip a hard dinghy getting on and off on a dock or getting on and off on a boat. Now, I will admit that every one of these situations usually has to do with a copious amount of alcohol, but you know, they're relatively easy to flip if you if you are half drunk and you try to get on your dinghy. The beauty of this for me, and the whole reason why I have one, is that I can fold this thing down to about the size of a surfboard, or maybe more appropriately, to the size of a stand-up paddleboard, and I can lash it to the side of my boat, and it's out of the way, and it's, you know, it's not going anywhere, and it solves the problem. I can also fit four people. It says you only can fit three people in this dinghy, but I can fit four people in it, and it's not the easiest thing to row. We row this thing. I don't have an outboard engine with me. Maybe I'll have an outboard in the future. You know, I've been rowing the boat for a lot of expeditions, and for almost, you know, I've been living on anchor since 2004, on and off. I've done I've spent a few years living on anchor, maybe 4 years or so living on anchor and all together in various locations. I've had to do a lot of rowing. I've just had a lot of problems with outboards, you know, small outboards. The carburetor gets all gunked up, and I've just, you know, I like having an outboard, and I have had outboards in the past, but it's just another thing to lug around. It's another thing that's going to break. It's another thing you got to spend money on. You got to buy fuel. Now you got fuel on your boat. You got jerry jugs on your boat. You know, it's, I got a diesel engine. You know, do I really want to have to mess around with gasoline? They don't make diesel outboards. At least I've never seen a small diesel outboard. I'm pretty sure they don't make them. I don't want to have another fuel. You know, my oars, I got metal oars on this, so I'm not going to whittle through them. And my arms, well, I don't think my arms are going to break. I hope not. So, I've got a way to get the dinghy around. But, yeah, it's sitting over there. I'm not even sure if I'm going to be able to row back to my boat, to be honest. I'm starting to really get cold at this point because, you know, I'm soaking wet. I mean, I'm hiding under the shelter, and it's raining all around me. But, you know, when you're walking around, you stay warm. But I've been sitting now for a while. You know, whatever. I mean, it's not like I'm going to die or anything. I'm not going to lose my limbs to frostbite. If I were in the same location as I am now in the winter, it'd be like negative 30, negative 40. And then being cold, you'd kill you very quickly. And of course, the water is freezing cold right now. I mean, it's not frozen, but I think if you were to fall in the water, you'd only last maybe 3 or 4 minutes before your body went into shock and you die. So it's important to have a dinghy that's going to be stable, obviously, under these circumstances, because you really, really don't want to wind up in the water. It'd be a really bad move. Now that the sun has come out a bit, I can see the different colors of green in the water. The water up here isn't as clear as the water south. The clearest water I've seen so far in Greenland was last year above Upernavik and below the nature reserve. I don't know why the water is so much clearer there. It's like, you know, Bahamas clear, Caribbean clear. It's, you can see down 25, 30 feet. You can, when you drop an anchor, you can count every link on the chain. You know, it's incredibly clear water. I find it a bit surprising. The reason the water isn't as clear up here is because these fjords are constantly bringing soot and dirt into the water. You know, as the glaciers melt, they also bring dirt, sand, they bring all that into the water with it. So the water's a bit cloudy because of the activity of the glaciers. I'm surrounded by mountains, of course. It's very rocky Greenland, so there's mountains sort of all around me. You couldn't really walk up them very easily. It'd be a nightmare to try to get up them. And since I'm so far north, most of them are covered with ice caps. So on top of this mountain cliff thing that's, you know, 1,000 feet tall or something, there will be an ice cap on top of that that's maybe another couple hundred feet. You know, it's really beautiful. Some of the ice caps work their way down the ravines. It looks like icing on a cake. You know, it looks like somebody took a bunch of icing and smeared it on top of these rocky mountainy cliffs. And I mean, it really looks Arctic up here, but you know, like I said, I'm at 77 and a half north. I mean, what do you expect? It is it's 800 miles from the North Pole. So anyways, I'll be heading back to the boat shortly. I'm going to try to drag it. Because I'm at low tide, there's all these like mud flats and sand flats, and they weren't here when I came over in the dinghy a few hours ago. The tide has went out more. I don't know if I can get back to the boat or not. I might have to sort of pull the boat through the water. I hope not. The only thing that's warm right now are my feet. And the only thing that's dry are my feet. If I got to lug a boat through the water, they're going to be soaking wet and freezing cold. But I got to get back to the boats. I need to have some coffee. I haven't had breakfast yet. The crew is probably still sleeping, but they're going to wake up when I start frying some onions and potatoes, I'm sure, and they're going to want to eat. So we have some videos on the website of the expedition. We got a couple up right now. Check out oceanresearchproject.org. You can read the blogs. You can see where we are. We have a tracking device. You can always donate via PayPal on the website. We cannot exist without donations. And so, yeah, please support our research. And, yeah, until next time, have a good week, and hopefully everything will go well up here. Talk to you guys later.
Luar negeri, kau nak kau, kau nak ikhlas, kau nak syukur.
Hi, I'm Sarah O'Kelly, founder of Skipper's Review. I started Skipper's Review because I wanted somewhere online for my local boating community to make connections and recommendations. So now it's up and running. I've been getting out of the office to enjoy the Florida sunshine and to meet some of my members. Each week, you can hear me swapping salty tales with sailors, surfers, swimmers, divers, boat owners, and builders, anyone with a story to tell about their life and their relationship with the sea. So join me, Sarah O'Kelly, with Skipper's Review on Boat Radio.